attend the classes at Boston?
I did when he was in Boston.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
I've just been attending for the last 1 year and I think a few months.
Right. Oh, good. Oh, so you know Laura Fairuden.
Sorry? I know more of?
Laura Fairuden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you practicing?
I am.
Oh.
A little bit.
Okay. From your home or you have a clinic?
Sorry?
You have a clinic or home?
I have an office at a chiropractor.
Oh, I see.
Hi, this is Barbara in California. I'm assuming the call hasn't started yet.
Right. Kathleen from Boston.
Hi, Kathleen.
Cynthia from New Jersey.
Hi, Cynthia.
I'm Krishna from Indiana.
Hi, Krishna.
Oh. Hi, Krishna.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, you sound like an Indian.
Oh, is it? I am an Indian.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Hey, how's everyone doing this evening?
Pretty good.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Is it raining up there?
You know, it was raining a little bit earlier today, but it's looking pretty good right now. Well, it's cloudy, but it's looking okay.
Good.
How about where you are?
I'm in Marin. This is Barbara from Marin.
Oh, okay.
It's raining. It's wet. It's been raining all day.
Okay, which Barbara is this?
Juniper.
Oh, hey, Barbara.
Hey.
Who else is on the call this evening?
Krishna from Indiana. He came. How are you?
Hi, Krishna. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Good.
Kathleen from Boston.
Hey, Kathleen, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Stephanie from Homestead.
Who?
Stephanie from Homestead, Florida.
Homestead, Florida. I know where that is.
Way down here.
Yeah, where all the cow pastures are.
We're not quite that bad.
Well, welcome to the call. Who else
Thank
is
you.
On this evening?
Oh, this is Lori Arboreal from
Hey. Hi, how are you
Michigan.
This evening?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Hi,
this is
Lori Franco, Las Vegas.
Hi, how are you this evening?
Very good, thank you.
Good.
Hi, this is Cindy Simmons from Toronto.
Hi, Cindy, how are you this evening?
I'm good, Kim, thank you.
Good.
This is Mary Terhune from Boston.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Great, Kim, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Leilani Lewis saying aloha from Hawaii.
Hey, Leilani, how are you?
Fine, Kim.
How's the weather there in Hawaii?
Just lovely.
Oh, good. I'm sure you're making everyone envious.
And I'm glad you're having this teleconference with Dr. Luke.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Luke is, well, not only is he, an excellent homeopath and teacher, but he's been so generous with his time, you know, just.
So today, who is taking the game?
It's with Dr. Luke DeShepper is the call.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's been extremely, extremely kind in terms of his time. I mean, I think this is probably maybe the fifth or sixth.
Well, he will speak a bit more, more voice. Yesterday it was very soft voice.
Yeah, well, you know, yesterday, I don't know for those of you who were on the call yesterday, the person who was being interviewed had to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning because.
Oh yeah.
So she was pretty tired probably when she was talking.
Which one was that yesterday?
Alice.
With Elise.
Alice.
Yeah.
Alice.
For those of you who missed it, it was recorded and it will be posted up on our website.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Kim.
I thought Elise spoke beautifully.
You thought she spoke beautifully?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Good.
This is Therese. The hummingbird lady from Grizzly Flats, California.
Oh, you're the hummingbird doctor.
Right.
Amazing. Yeah, for those people who don't know who this is, there's a woman, Shirley Casey, who does a lot of work using homeopathy with wildlife, and she mentioned that there was a woman out there who was treating hummingbirds using homeopathy and that she could tell that a hummingbird was sick. Correct me if I'm wrong here. She could tell if the hummingbird was sick by the fact that a feather was out of place. Is that correct?
Wow. Well, if a feather is out of place, maybe there is something going on, not necessarily something tragic, but certainly something has happened.
Interesting. We actually have quite a large number of hummingbirds in our garden. There's, quite a number.
Well, they respond beautifully to homeopathy.
Is that right?
Beautifully. I haven't used any allopathic medicines on my hummingbirds since 1997.
And what do? You put it in the feeder, the remedy?
No, no. When a hummingbird is injured, it's usually some head trauma is involved, and they don't even know where they are.
Hmm.
And they're found on the ground, and they're brought in for rehabilitation.
Wow.
So I dissolve a pellet and administer it in just a tenth of a cc of distilled water.
Fantastic. Ooh, anybody else on the call? Is Dr. Luke, are you on yet?
Hello.
Yes,
Dr. Luke, you've joined us?
Hello.
Hello, I'm just here.
Okay, very good. All right, so good. We're going to go ahead and get started. There sounds like there's a good number of people on the call. I'm going to use the same format that we always do. I'm going to conduct a formal interview for the first 45 minutes or so, and then during that time, people will be muted out, and then I will unmute the call, and people can ask questions as they would like. So let me go ahead and mute everyone out. You don't have to do anything. I'll take care of muting you and unmuting you. Dr. Luke, can you still hear me?
Yes, still hear you.
Okay, very good. So first of all, let me thank you again for being so generous with your time. I had lost count, actually, of how many of these calls you've done, but I believe it's something like six or seven of these calls already. And I know you're so busy with all the books that you're writing and the classes that you teach and everything that you do for homeopathy, all the contributions that you make to take additional time out and join us for these calls, I think is just extremely, extremely kind, extremely generous, and I know that everyone who's participated has appreciated it greatly. It's always a pleasure to introduce Dr. Luke. He really is one of the great treasures that we have in homeopathy, absolutely one of the most brilliant scholars, somebody who is completely committed and dedicated to not only learning and teaching and practicing in homeopathy, but really educating others so that they can become proficient themselves. He's taught all over North America. He's taught in Europe. He's the author of, Luke, how many books now?
I think it's 14.
14 books. So he's a very prolific writer. And I have to say, I almost finished reading his latest book, Achieving and Maintaining the Similimum, and I am absolutely convinced that this is one of the most important works that we have in homeopathy. It is incredibly lucid, and he addresses many different, very difficult issues in homeopathy that have largely not been explored to the depth that he has discussed them. And these are fundamental issues if you want to be successful in practice, because they're issues that relate to case management, the second prescription, and really this is what homeopathy is all about. So I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Allison Burden, who usually joins us for these calls, was not able to be on this evening, so she wanted me to extend a special offer for anybody who does participate in the call this evening and would like to purchase the book. They can go to wholehealthnow.com/books, and if they type in the comments box that they participated in the call, they will get an additional discount off the already low prices. So that's wholehealthnow.com/books. And if they put in the comments that they participated in the Luke DeShepherd teleconference call, they will get an additional discount off the price. I also would like to mention that Dr. Luke is going to be offering a seminar in Los Angeles on December 18th and 19th entitled Maintaining the Similimum. And this is going to be in Los Angeles at the American University of Complementary Medicine. I cannot, again, recommend that you high enough that you take these classes with Luke. I don't know how much longer Luke is going to be continuing to teach homeopathy, but if you have an opportunity to stay with him, or if you haven't yet done this, please take the opportunity to do this, because I know it will dramatically accelerate your understanding of homeopathy in a variety of ways. He's an absolutely natural and gifted teacher, and the information that he imparts is extremely – I can't emphasize enough how important this information is. So, again, this is on December 18th and 19th in Los Angeles. The title of the seminar is Maintaining the Similimum. It's at the American University of Complementary Medicine. The phone number, if you want to get more information, is 310-914-4116. If you want to send an email, it's AUCM_events. That's AUCM as in Mary, @yahoo.com. So the phone number again is 310-914-4116, and the email address is AUCM_events@yahoo.com. Luke, you're also offering some seminars in Las Vegas. How could they get information about that?
Just simply email me at drluke@cybermesa.com.
Okay, so that's drluke, L-U-C, at cyber, C-Y-B-E-R, Mesa, M-E-S-A, .com. Again, I'm sure some of the people on this call are already students of Luke's. Hopefully at the end when they get to participate, they can give their own testimonials of the value of his teaching, because pretty much everyone who studies with Luke only has positive things to say. So anyway, Luke, thank you again for joining us on the call. It's really incredibly generous of you, and I know everyone appreciates it greatly.
Thank you for your kind words, and I always love doing this because I know I have a passion for homeopathy, and I think my greatest compensation is my wonderful loyal students that I have and everybody else, you know, who does practice homeopathy, because it is really the road less traveled, I would say, but also in a road very difficult, but certainly it is a road that will give you a lot of wonderful, wonderful things coming to you, recompensations, nothing like you could get anywhere else.
Thank you, Luke. So, Luke, you know, again, you're the one who usually suggests the subject of these calls, and you had suggested that we do one on the topic of Forsaken. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, always some students give me some kind of a tip, and recently a very good homeopath from Canada asked me the question, how do I translate lack of emotional nourishment, I guess, with one of her patients? And of course, it is not uncommon that we have difficulties translating the language of the patient into the language of the repertorium. Now, with time, of course, with expertise, with experience, through time, through practice, and also through familiarizing yourself with the provings in the Materia Medica or with rubrics in your repertorium, one can get used to it a little bit. And, you know, I have caught myself often of just whenever I talk to people, I almost automatically translate it into rubrics. Maybe that's a bad thing. We may have a delusion there, too. But anyway, it's kind of something that comes automatically. And so when I got that question, and again, too, this is not uncommon, you know, for not just even for the beginner homeopath, but, you know, it remains a certain aspect of difficulty to translate that language. So my answer to her, now with the patient with the lack of emotional nourishment, was forsaken. Now, when we think about the definition of forsaken, it's a feeling of being alone, often abandoned not only by friends but also by family, to the point of rejection, as we can see. So friends often become strangers. Often a patient feels alone, he's in a room. And sometimes we say surrounded by high walls with a sense of isolation. So that's kind of a definition of forsaken. Now, you would be surprised, by the way, how many different delusions are covering that concept of forsaken. So it's not just, you know, the lack of emotional nourishment is not just covered, obviously, by the rubric forsaken, but by many, many delusions, different delusions. Basically, delusions, as we know, are fixed ideas, but certainly they are an intensity. They really give away an intensity of the patient, of the feeling of the patient, much more than normal. Since delusions, as we know, will the patient make him do, think and do and plan everything is according to that particularly fixed idea. So in other words, the driving force behind everything that he thinks and he does is actually driven by that delusion, by that fixed idea. So when, of course, unfortunately, patients don't come on a visit. I have never had anybody in 30 years in my practice coming on a visit and say, Dr. Luke, I have the delusion, I am forsaken. They don't come that way. But they have expressions like, I don't think anybody cares about me. Or I feel totally invisible in this world. Or some people say to me, even when I'm all around people, I'm in this mass of people and I still feel alone. Other people say, I just feel like an outcast. I am not belonging anywhere. No one ever thinks about me. Those are all particularly patients' expressions that all really point towards the element forsaken. I have often heard, you know, and unfortunately, my parents always favored my sisters. Here again, we may think about forsaken, lack of emotional nourishment. Or, as I was born 8 years after my sister, I was considered the mistake in the family. Even, you know, again, too, this might not have been said, but even if it was taught by the mother intrautero during the pregnancy, this has a great repercussion on the newborn, who will probably be born with the delusion and the feeling of forsaken. Or I have heard my father was hoping I would have been a boy. As you can see, many of these fixed ideas or delusions find their origin in fixed emotions. And in women, by the way, the origin of most of the delusions, or plenty of delusions, is linked to love. I'm sure Jung would totally agree with that, and of course Freud even more. But certainly in women, the lack of love, loss of love, fear of loss of love, and unrequited love are all basically covered by different remedies, and all by different remedies that have in common the delusion or the element, the rubric, forsaken. So that's basically what you have in common with that. And so we must be able to listen very carefully what the patient says, and you would be surprised sometimes that the patient really speaks with the same terminology as that we found in the proving symptoms. And of course, hearing guiding symptoms is one of my favorites. So keep that in mind. Always listen very carefully exactly how the patient expresses him or herself. Make sure to write it down, because sometimes one word that you write down wrong will give you a totally different interpretation. So that's a very important facet of it.
Luke, thank you. You're always amazing, Luke. Your answers, I ask you a simple question, you always come back with such a deep and profound answer. It's something else. Luke, I know you've done a lot of work with delusions. I don't know if people even know this, but probably more than anybody else, you've really clarified the meaning of all of these different delusions that sometimes we just don't know how to use in the repertory. Can you give us examples of delusions that specifically relate to this quality of being forsaken?
Yeah, you're right, Kim. I always have been very fascinated with delusion, and certainly it has its very special reasons. Now, when we think about forsaken, some delusions I really have been thinking about, what kind of delusions really would all go to the concept of forsaken, or the sense of isolation and the lack of emotional nourishment. So I think besides this, you know, often when we have that element of forsaken, we just stop at the rubric forsaken or ailments from forsaken. But we need to think more about what else can we actually imply there, what else can we add to it, because there again, too, we must realize that many, many remedies will actually express the same kind of rubric, isolation and delusion of isolation, and yet for all different reasons. So thinking about all that, I was looking at all these different delusions, and we have about 2,332 in the synthesis, by the way. So when I tried to actually put the delusions that are really linked to the concept of forsaken together, so here are some. And, you know, once in a while I will mention a remedy, but, of course, we will see a little bit later how we can discuss in more detail some of them. So we have, for instance, the delusions all alone in the wilderness. You know, obviously we have that with Stramonium. Delusions all alone in the world. You know, all that reflects, obviously, the forsaken, and certainly a very deep sense of forsaken, not just feeling a little bit alone, certainly a sense of isolation, as I would say. We have other ones like delusion she is not appreciated. Interesting remedies, palladium and tuya. We have delusion, all her friends are dead and she must go to a convent. A very special one indeed, of lac defloratum. We have the delusion his mother is dead. Certainly it's the mother figure in the family plays a crucial role in the upbringing of the patient, of any patient, of any human being, I would say. So the delusion mother is dead will refer to that nourishing element that we really should get and all should get in the beginning of our life until we are more independent. We see remedies like anacardium, nepmure, lachesis, all belonging to delusion mother is dead. We have also delusion has lost affection of his friends. Delusion he is friendless, which is, of course, about the same thing. We also have delusion he will never be happy in his own house. I was surprised to find our cynicum, but they're not surprised. We also have delusions calling for help, again, too, that belongs to the concept of forsaken. We have the delusions he or she is neglected. He feels neglected. Very unfortunate, and we often have to use this, obviously, in the ailments from domination, as we can certainly look at as a very great causality of forsaken. We have also, he is repudiated by his relatives. That is, of course, a very deep sense of isolation and certainly belonging to remedies like lacaninum, dog's milk, who is the Cinderella of the Materia Medica. We have delusions, he is separated from the world. We have delusions, friends appear as strangers, and not in the least, we have a delusion that she is alone in a graveyard, which is Miss Sepia, the unfortunate Sepia, who sometimes probably doesn't wish to be nothing better than being in a graveyard, but at the same time does feel in her ultimate exhausted state, always like in a graveyard. As you see, I mentioned just here and there some of the remedies, just to make you aware of it, of the fact that we have many, many remedies, all reflecting the concept of forsaken, but here we must remember that in order to know the real essence of a remedy, we need to, of course, ask ourselves for what reason, as Jung really classically referred to, the motivation behind the behavior of the patient will give us actually the differential diagnosis between these different remedies. So make sure, I think, probably the most important question, and I always bring this up to my students, is to ask always your patient, why and for what reason? What motivates you to feel that way, to do it that way, to act that way, to compensate that way? All of the above. But we must above all remember that to know the real essence of the remedy is to, one needs to investigate these delusions as they are the deepest pathology. So there's several pages, 20, 30 pages in our rubrics, in our repertorium, as little as they are investigated, should be investigated with every patient. And with every patient, we should be able to find what I would call a core delusion, which is basically really, once you can find that, it really reflects the similimum above all. And, of course, we all have delusions, unfortunately or fortunately.
Luke, I know that, you know, for a lot of people on this call, this idea of delusions is probably a new one. So could you maybe elaborate a little bit about why these are so important to the homeopath?
Yeah, it is important. If we just think about it, Kim, if we really think about it, when we want to find the similimum with the patient, Hahnemann, of course, has given us wonderful guidelines, but trying to find what he calls the aphorism 153 rubrics, which are, of course, the rare, peculiar, and strange symptoms. Now, nothing is probably more rare and peculiar, or maybe very special and individual, as the delusions belonging to the patient, and certainly Jung, who is one of my favorite to study, also always stresses the individuality of the patient. But besides the rare, peculiar, and strange symptoms, there is also a far more important reason to think about delusions to be that important. Think about it. Whenever we choose the rubrics for our patient to find the similimum, it's not only that they have to be rare, peculiar, and strange, but they also must be permanent. The permanency of a symptom is extremely important. So to reach a level of permanency to prescribe on it, to prescribe on certain symptoms, they have to reach a level of permanency. Now, we don't prescribe quickly on symptoms that appear one day and disappear the next day. We always have to at least wait at that point a little bit to find out if those symptoms are going to remain permanent. And, of course, as we know, according to Herring, those last appearing symptoms, once they are permanent, are extremely important for our prescription for the similimum. So you can imagine, if we say permanency of symptoms, per definition, a delusion is a fixed idea that rules the patient's life, that makes him do and plan everything according to delusions. There is probably nothing more permanent than fixed, as you must know. So hence, the core delusion is the most important rubric to resolve the case. And how to resolve that is the topic of my next book, obviously, and that's 600-700 pages. I'm going to need another 2 years. But it's also the topic of my lecture in New Jersey in December, and one of my most favorite lectures, because it is amazing how we can discover with each case that is presented that we actually are able to find these fixed permanent ideas, these deep-seated feelings, I must say, that often we are, unfortunately, in fact, that we are addicted to. We are addicted to certain feelings, often negative, often sometimes positive, but very often negative, linked, as we said before, especially with women and men, to love in general, but also we have, of course, many other different reasons. That's so very important for us to be able to discover the delusion in the patient and, above all, of course, to give a decent explanation to the delusion. So how it fits in the whole story, and often Jung would have said that it's always a story, and the story often is a secret story. Really remains, I would say, even unknown to the patient, because that is, of course, his core delusion, is, of course, the compensation that he will do in order to avoid all the tribulations, in order to really survive. So in other words, compensation is done every day by each of us in a very great or smaller degree, but we all must do it, and if, above all, if we recognize what we are doing, it is actually the beginning of our cure.
Luke, you mentioned, when I asked you the question about the delusions, you mentioned a whole list of delusions, and I was curious, is there a remedy that comes to mind that would cover some of those delusions that you mentioned, and the person needing that remedy, how would they deal with these delusions in general?
Yeah, that's of course this next important question, as we say. So, you know, it's not only important to discover what kind of delusions this person has, who has now the sense of isolation, you know, or forsaken. That's important, of course, obviously, which one that we have to address. But even more important is, how do they compensate for it? Now, how do they react to it? And let me just give you an example of a remedy with a forsaken delusion, and then it will come a little bit more clear. Let's just say one of the remedies that comes to my mind now is stramonium. Now, the real issue of a stramonium, whenever I discuss delusions, I always try to find the never-well since, you know, what we call ailments from, what Jung would have called the really the motivation, the associations, he would say the meaningful associations, so the never-well since for us is the first thing that I think of, but then I think also, so how did this person, coming from this never-well since, how did that person react? And let's just see how stramonium is doing that. I think the real issue, or the never-well sins, with stramonium is the abandonment by a parent or a trusted person that is very much outspoken. And when I think about this theme, obviously stramonium is not alone. I mean, there's other remedies. I think, for instance, of lysine, you know, the saliva of the rabid dog, and of hyoscyamus, who both have a similar theme of being betrayed or left, and that is, of course, real or not real, by those on who they are dependent on. So, you know, lysine, hyoscyamus, and stramonium have that similar theme, without any doubt. But stramonium, the poor person, has this great need and certainly feels so quickly abandoned because they don't feel up to par to defend themselves against everything that's threatened them out in this world. So, in other words, for them, they have the delusion all alone in the wilderness. For them, the world is not a safe environment. It is a very harsh environment, for which they will need the guidance and certainly the presence of people that are very close to them. And we, of course, think about family in the first place. I mean, we look just at the delusions of stramonium. If you look at it, they're all about seeing animals, threatening animals, black dogs, wild animals, certain procession of beetles. They go crawling on them. They try to catch them. They can't. So as you can clearly see, the world is a dangerous place for them. And certainly it becomes much more dangerous, as we all know, as the transition in the day takes place from bright to dark. Twilight zone is absolutely a frightening moment for the stramonium, as he intensely fears the dark, especially when he is alone. So he will really hang on to the parents that he is with. I had so many beautiful examples. Just think about one, that I had this wonderful patient, 14-year-old boy, who was really on medications for separation anxiety. Here again, too, is something that, you know, instead of forsaken, we can just talk about separation anxiety. All of those delusions that I have mentioned would reflect the separation anxiety. I remember very much how he was on a very bad, very strong medication, allopathic medication, for 4 years, and suffered just as much as before. It was quite amazing for me to see that when he was even in a place where he enjoyed himself, like Disneyland with his parents, that on the moment that the light was going down and it was going to go to the twilight zone, he absolutely requested to go home. He was just urging his parents to go home. It was a beautiful case of stramonium, and to my joy, I could really restore that within a couple of months and without the medication. Again, there are two. Those are wonderful cases of stramonium, who has, of course, always these delusions of these frightful animals jumping out of the ground is how they really think about it. Think about that terrorized state of the stramonium patient, you know, who views the world always as a very dangerous place. You know what happens, of course, even with my patient, too, that I had, when they wake up in the middle of the night, they actually wake up like from a nightmare. And as you know, the stramonium classically will cling to those near them, you know, like the parents. They call out for their parents. They come near them, and then they don't even recognize the parents at first. It's a very classical reaction of the stramonium. And even waking up from this nightmare, they often speak very unintelligent, incomprehensible. So we see that it's very important. So the moment the stramonium leaves home, obviously he has to cling to someone, and usually that's a family member, a friend, and make sure that he will never leave that person out of sight. That makes you think maybe of Silica too, by the way, right, who cannot leave home without really clinging to somebody. And certainly in Silica, we see the delusion, half of his body does not belong to him. His left side does not belong to his right side. But you can clearly see, it's a beautiful case here to compare Silica then to stramonium. With Silica, it's not a question of forsaken. With stramonium, it is. With Silica, it's not a question of forsaken. It's just a question of lack of self-confidence. It's more a question of he is afraid that they're going to find out that he is not as strong as he wants to show, especially how he is at home. You know how Silica children at home, they can be pretty harsh. They can be pretty hard towards their family, even violent. They certainly have that kind of a strong ego at home. But watch out. The moment they open the door, 1 foot out of that door, and they are a totally different child. Often have I heard that from the parents. Oh, the teachers say, this child, my child, my Silica child, is such a beautiful little child, always really listening to me. And we think, well, what child are you talking about? That must not be my child. So as you clearly see, one must always ask why, for what reason. Why is the Silica child not appearing, doesn't want to go outside without the help of a family member? Because he has fear and timidity of appearing in public. Stramonium, because he is afraid of everything in the world. The world is a dark, dark side. So don't forget, we always have to pay attention as to when the abandonment took place. So often, and certainly in many stramonium cases, often the pregnant mother was in a forsaken state, terrified being alone, at a moment that she wanted more support, as you know, this can happen, and therefore transferring her feelings to the unborn child. So you will see stramonium is a violent remedy. How do they react to it, to that feeling, that sense of isolation, that sense of forsaken? They really react very furiously, delirious. You know, this is a very strong remedy, a very active remedy, and a very violent remedy. They react violently because they feel so much threatened. So they have to be striking, killing with a knife. We talk rage, fury, rudeness, striking, tearing things. In other words, as you see, certainly not a very passive person. They will react extremely, very strongly to actually get the attention of the person to protect them. They sure need protection. So as we see, there is always a story behind this forsaken. And make sure you ask that. So why? You try to be a good detective, as you all have to be. You try to get behind the thinking of this particular person. Why are they reacting this way? Why do they have this fixed idea that they are so forsaken? That, of course, will give you the differential diagnosis. With all this plenty of remedies, we probably have about 30, 40 that can really respond to forsaken.
Very interesting, Luke. You know, normally when we're talking about forsaken, I think the remedy that comes to mind for most people is pulsatilla. What about pulsatilla for forsaken?
Well, of course, pulsatilla. Poor pulsatilla. You know, there is nobody has a greater need for attention, so we can also imagine that pulsatilla can feel more alone than anybody else. just like Stramonium, obviously, they both are have the delusion all alone in the world. But again, here too, the reasons are very different, and that's what we really need to try to find out. For instance, a pulsatilla person always we feel abandoned unless all the attention is focused on her at all times. In other words, as we know, if you ever have a pulsatilla child or a pulsatilla patient, they're extremely needy. You know, they're driven by neediness. So whenever she is not involved, she feels, oh, nobody cares about me. I'm all alone in the world. So this jealousy that the pulsatilla person is going to show is really driven by the neediness for attention. And therefore, there is great anticipation, anxiety, and excitement in her behavior, greedy. You know, they want everything for themselves. A typical example would be, for instance, really, even when I talk to in front of those pulsatilla patients in the office, when I used to talk in front of the office, and I would talk to the parent, the pulsatilla child would always try to interrupt me, trying to say something. And, you know, this is often a complaint of parents, obviously, that they can never talk to each other without being interrupted by the pulsatilla child who wants me, I want to say something too. It is classical. Of course, even more, and you know, you'll think about it even quicker, I think, if there is a newborn in the family, and all of a sudden all the attention, as usual and normally, is geared towards that newcomer, and all of a sudden the pulsatilla person feels very much abandoned, and often will actually have regressive behavior. All of a sudden, they know they're smart enough to realize that if they have baby behavior, maybe they get just as much attention as that baby that is just this newcomer. And certainly at that point, although we know that pulsatilla is a more yielding, a more passive remedy, and certainly when she gets all the attention, then she's certainly yielding and certainly ameliorates with consolation, but you cannot underestimate a pulsatilla. I have always heard wonderful stories how the pulsatilla child would hide behind the door waiting for the little, you know, the little newcomer there who is running around in his little Rolls Royce, you know, those little cars that run around, and they would just slam the door on them, or they would just pinch them or hit them. And then, of course, when the baby would cry, they have this innocent face. Of course, they have never done anything. And who would ever think that this sweet little pulsatilla would have done such an act of jealousy? But, boy, they can. They are very much anxious. You know, we would be surprised how anxious they can be. And usually they are very submissive. So we can clearly see it's more of a passive behavior versus the active behavior of the stramonium. Certainly we know all the changeable behavior of the pulsatilla. You give them a little attention, they laugh. The laughter will follow tears very quickly. But if they are not, if things are not going their way, then they become more morose, dejected, and very irritable. You know, then they want this, they want that. They always want very many things, but they're never satisfied with anything. So very capricious, extremely capricious. You see, these reactions of pulsatilla are pretty much very different. And certainly another reason for a pulsatilla to feel abandoned is that she constantly requires attention to diffuse her great anxiety about disease. You know, you think pulsatilla cannot be hypochondriac, not for nothing, is it belonging to the carbon family. Certainly, adult pulsatilla has very anxious solicitude about her health, has tremendous anxiety as if death were imminent. So, again, too, talking about a little paranoia and a little bit hypochondriac behavior. So we can clearly see this in pulsatilla, but as you can clearly see, it is a different reason why she feels forsaken. They also react differently to it. We see clearly the difference between the never-well sins, the etiology, the motivation, and then how they will compensate, how they will actually try to get the attention from the one they want, obviously the parents most of the time. And I must say, I could recognize these pulsatilla children from miles long, and I don't think I have ever had more grateful parents than when I have treated those pulsatilla children with that wonderful remedy, that little windflower.
Look, you know, your differentials are just fabulous, I have to say. These are just, I can't think of anything that could be more useful than this type of differentials of how a remedy could manifest the quality of delusions. I'm curious, are there other remedies that also have this quality of forsaken, which are perhaps underprescribed because they're not as well known?
Yeah, we have many remedies, obviously, right? So, I mean, I think most of us know hyoscyamus, sepia, who also feel forsaken for different reasons, obviously, right? And when we think about hyoscyamus, and I want you to know, hyoscyamus and pulsatilla are very often mixed up. And we say hyoscyamus is probably also underprescribed versus pulsatilla, since hyoscyamus child, the etiology is definitely also a newcomer in the family. Just, I'm not going to talk about hyoscyamus that much, but just to give you an idea, hyoscyamus has the delusion that they're going to be sold. Isn't that a beautiful expression of feeling forsaken? They feel when a newcomer comes in the family, they say, that's it. I'm just gone. I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be sold on the slave market here. I'm not good anymore. You know, here is the newcomer. So you can clearly see the hyoscyamus, and you know all the reactions, you know, when they react to it, how they compensate. They are even not just even more violent than stramonium, but they actually more foolish behavior, as you must know. They do anything, especially sexual behavior, to attract the attention, of course, of the parent they would like to get the attention from. But there are remedies that we never would think that they would be forsaken. Let's think about our friend Platina. Who would ever think that the Empress, as I call her, the Miss Cleopatra, who could ever think that such an haughty person would feel forsaken? You know, and yet she has the delusion she is all alone in the world. So there must be very different reason for Platina than for somebody like Pulsatilla, of course, or what we already have discussed, the other remedy, stramonium. Indeed, let's have a quick look at Platina. Now, Platina is a very passionate, very hypersexual and romantic person. But why is she isolated? She is isolated because when she wants a partner, when a Platina person wants a partner, as you can clearly see, it's about love again, they want a partner who is at the same time very sexual, but at the same time she wants that same person also to be very spiritual. Now, that's an extremely rare combination that we might only find in another Platina person. And obviously, there can only be one empress at a time. So you can clearly see there is always a conflict between, on one hand, the hypersexual desire of that person, and on the other hand, the romantic nature of the person who wants that spiritual companion. And this, of course, will always lead to a series of heartbreaks. And by the way, here again, we can clearly see how we can, therefore, we must compare it with Nat Moore. We can confuse it easily with Nat Moore because Nat Moore obviously has also this series of heartbreaks in a row. So as you can clearly see, Platina is even more alone in the world than Pulsatilla because Platina even says that she doesn't even belong to her own family and she has no place in this family and she has no place in the world even. So we clearly see this in the Provings where it says she thinks she's left wholly to herself and stands all alone in the world. So as you clearly see, the high expectations of Platina lead to an anguish, great fear of death, and at the same time, because of her haughtiness, is certainly a further cause of her isolation. Now, we all know the haughtiness and the delusions of the Cleopatra or Miss Platina, where on entering the house, everything is very small, all the persons are physically and mentally inferior, but she herself is very superior and physically larger. And also that delusion of humility of others while she is great. You see, clearly, this doesn't make her any points with most people, and therefore, she feels very isolated. She can't find a companion because of her duality, of that dual nature that she has, spiritual and sexual, and her haughty nature obviously upset many people, and therefore, she's isolated. This is a very different reason, and we don't think about forsaken when we think about Platina that often. But the repercussions, as we know, for Platina, as well as for Nat Moore, are very similar. They all go on the central nervous system, and we definitely, when phys- physical illness occurs in both elements, and that's another reason that we can confuse it very easily, are multiple sclerosis, paralysis, or an infection on the central nervous system. So keep in mind for all of you that if NetMuir didn't work, one must think about Platina. If Pulsativa doesn't work, one must think about ISM. So again, the why, for what reason, and how do they compensate? It's just the most wonderful way of looking at the different remedies in homeopathy.
Luke, I know you wrote a very excellent book on the periodic table in homeopathy, and I'm curious, can you, in the periodic table, are there outstanding elements that relate to isolation?
Yeah, this periodic table is a fun way to look at remedies too, and people, by the way. And certainly when you look in the, you know, I'm not sure if anybody is familiar with periodic table in homeopathy, but in group 1 and 2 of all the levels, we have very dependent and insecure, naive remedies. But there is just one element that I want to say a little bit more about it, and that's the magnesium element. Now, again, because it's not always very well known, the magnesium element, by the way, has a theme of infantile dependency. In other words, they are dependent even on the moment they shouldn't be dependent, just like little children. And when we look at the magnesiums, we have MagCarb, magnesium carbonicum, we have magnesium muriaticum, and I'll just mention a few words of each of those remedies to show to you how they feel isolated. The magnesium carbonicum, you know, Kent called this the orphan of the Materia Medica. I call it the Oliver Twist of the Materia Medica, who is very isolated, as you know, because the poor guy dreams of being lost not only in the forest, as they say, but also at home. So here is an element, magnesium carbonicum, truly, truly, who is the Oliver Twist, who really finds nobody to fall back on, and who is really threatened, you know, for his survival, who must do anything for his survival, and therefore, by the way, has not many delusions, not like magnesium muriaticum. You know, obviously, magnesium carbonicum has to be very practical and cannot afford to have many delusions, but this is a whole different game with the magnesium muriaticum. When we say magnesium muriaticum, those are people, children, teenagers that already have known a good relationship with their parents, for instance, or an adult, a magnesium muriaticum adult, who has already had known a relationship, but it didn't pan out. In other words, they lost it. What's going to, at that point, of course, they can have the delusion that they are forsaken by their friends, which is very classically magnesium muriaticum. Therefore, coming from this, again, from this forsaken love, has a lot of delusions or fixed idea. The best example I can give, for instance, is a child of divorcing parents or finding parents, especially when it happens around puberty, which Jung called times of turmoil, and of course, which we know are times that the miasmatic states will actually, if they were latent before, will certainly become active, and we see this child changing. But a magnesium muriaticum child, in such circumstances, will do anything to keep the peace, to keep the parents together, even repressing his own emotions. And of course, repression is much worse than suppression. So whenever we do that, certainly the physical body will succumb under this. And what I really see, we should think about it when we see teenagers who actually, in such circumstances, around puberty, are all of a sudden having no behavior of bulimia and anorexia nervosa. You know, so there's a great remedy. Have been using that in many instances. If, of course, the picture fits, obviously, that's what we have to keep in mind.
Luke, it seems like from pretty much the remedies that you've described so far, a common theme is this perceived lack of love, especially on people on whom they depend. Is there a different theme that leads to a sense of isolation in people?
Well, that's true. That's a very good observation, Kim, that you're doing, and I'm sure that Jung and especially Freud would have been proud of me thinking about love in the first place as a source of many delusions. But we should not be surprised, and certainly Jung wasn't. Freud was, of course, much more sexual-oriented and love-oriented. But we should not be surprised that the concept of love plays such an important role in the cases of isolation and forsaken feeling. But they are not the only ones. You know, there are many other factors that lead to isolation. Think about physical handicaps. You know, a child with a physical handicap, another with a physical handicap. I think about Nat Muir with the delusion, is wretched, when looking in the mirror. You know, we think about maybe a person with a scarring acne, a teenager with a scarring acne, a tuya, which leads to the delusion of having disgust with himself. The body is ugly. The body is short. You know, we have this illness from domination. Certainly has nothing to do with love. It's just the opposite. Illness from domination, and I have this most wonderful remedies. We talk 3 hours about it, or a whole day, actually. We have remedies like, obviously, carcinosum, staphysagra, nitric acid. We have Hura brasiliensis, alumina, and so many more remedies that are really have everything to do with illness from domination, certainly not anything with love. I think about people who are really isolated when they immigrate from a foreign country, often leading to what I would call a Baryta Karp state, because a Baryta Karp has the delusion that they're walking on their knees because they feel that handicap. They have that loss of confidence because of language and cultural differences, of course. We have, of course, cases of isolation like sepia because they're totally exhausted. So that's a totally different reason there, too. We don't have to just think about love and loss of love. And then I think about the theme of poverty. You know, poverty can lead to great isolation because it leads to great worry. And I think about Sorainen, for instance, and I'll say a couple of words about Sorainen. So we can think about that. We can think about isolation in a new work. You know, you have a new job, and as a newcomer, you might be exposed to indignation situation from the boss, and others don't dare or care to intervene. Again, that's very important for us. So we can even be isolated, and the most best example is Argentin nitricum, by the way, because of that great degree of anticipation anxiety to the point where in the final state of Argentin nitricum, the Argentin nitricum doesn't even dare to get out of the home. So you can clearly see there are many more situations leading to isolation, but affairs of the heart, of course, has to be one of those leading causes. Nevertheless, everything what I have mentioned before, we should therefore investigate and ask after that in with every particular patient who has that sense of isolation, who feels that he has emotional lack of emotional nourishment. So as you see, we must always be like great detectives, Sherlock Holmes, and ask those all-important questions, why, for what reason, what is the motivation of the patient's behavior behind this, always knowing that the patient will compensate. They will not come with the real rubrics to us. They will compensate, and we must get to the real feeling by asking those whys and for what reason are the patients doing this kind of thing. You know, Sorainen, for instance, just to give you a quick idea, obviously, Sorainen is a worrywart. It's always very pessimistic, always struggles with life, always feel in great despair of recovery, even when they're recovering. So we can imagine that they feel pretty much isolated, and combine that to the bad body odor they have, and eructases like rotten eggs, that doesn't, of course, give you any more friends, and certainly this becomes the remedy of gloom and doom. And now we don't want to be around that kind of guy. And I certainly remember when I had one person like this in my medical school, by the way, when I think about it, when we were, you know, we were really linked to in our laboratoriums in chemistry, where we had to be 4 hours a day, four days a week, and I was next to a person, the unfortunate person, I always remember this, who probably needed Sorainen. I just didn't know it, obviously, at that point. I was just knowing nothing. I thought I knew something, but I didn't know anything. But I still remember it to this day, and that's now 35 years ago. And I wish she could walk into my door because I would love to help her because I can nothing. I mean, can you imagine what an isolation this must be for people? I even had a student, by the way, who actually had this body odor, and she would step on the train, and people would comment around her, what stinks here? You know, can you imagine what an isolation, what a tragedy for the person, and how homeopathy can really beautifully help. I can't tell you enough how much I love homeopathy, and I hope that all of you stay on that, on the road of good homeopathy. Not really anything that we have so much from Hahnemann. We got so much from him that really, let's study him first and let's then build on everything else. So this probably would be enough, and I'm always looking forward to have some questions from the audience.
Wow, Luke, that was just such a rich call, so full of information. I'm really just blown away. It's just, that was just really incredible. And thank you so much again for taking the time out. Let me just reiterate that you are going to be in Los Angeles on December 18th and 19th, offering a seminar called Maintaining the Similimum. And for people who are interested in getting more information about that, they can call 310-914-4116, or they can email AUCM_events, that's plural, EVENTS, at yahoo.com. Also, Luke is teaching, I believe, in New Jersey and also in Las Vegas. Are there other locations here in North America?
Yes, in Longmont, Colorado, actually, in November, and then also in February, April, May, and June.
Okay, fantastic. So if you want more information about where you could actually have the opportunity to study with Luke live in person directly, you can email him at Dr. Luke, that's D-R, Luke, L-U-C, at CyberMesa, that's CyberMesa.com. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and unmute, and people can go ahead and ask questions. Questions?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Lucas, Leilani.
Hey, Leilani.
Hey.
Long time no see.
Yes. I'm a very happy student of yours. My question is, and it's also an observation that, you know, I have a cat that has been sick, and I keep seeing that he appears to have delusions of being forsaken and deserted, and whenever I leave the house, he gets scared, and I was wondering if you could talk about that in terms of our animal friends.
Yes, that's indeed, you know, so here again, too, sometimes we think, well, we can't really think about the emotions of our animal friends, yet we all know who have, of course, animals, that dogs, cats, horses, name it, have really feelings. And it's up to us again, and I have great admiration for my students, vets, who do an excellent job of trying to observe the symptoms, you know, because it's all observation. Obviously, we can't ask them any questions. But certainly, I think whoever has cats, dogs, and horses, when we are very familiar with them and really in tune with them, we can observe many, many things. And as Leilani said, we can observe those delusions. You know, there's no doubt about it. The same questions we need to ask ourselves. How do they react? What do we see? And what do they do? Do they go and climb under the table? You know, do they stay at the door? Do they get angry and destroy things of ourselves? You know, I know my dog, who I just rescued, whenever we leave, we must make sure that everything is put away, because before we did it, she got her snout into the garbage can and just wanted to destroy. Or she wants to destroy something from my wife, because she feels she is so much in tune with my wife that she needs to punish her. She thinks, I'm going to punish her, and she doesn't care. She knows she does wrong, but she doesn't care as long as she gets the attention. So here again, too, you know, don't think that you, in animals, you must only prescribe on the physical symptoms. That, in my opinion, is very wrong, just as wrong as we would prescribe on physical symptoms, just in human beings, too. We must be, and I must say, I have excellent homeopathic veterinary students, and I love to do any case of animals anytime, because it is just a wonderful thing to, you know, to for our skills, to really observe. You know, again, there, too, it teaches us to observe as much as we should observe with human beings.
Great. Okay, hold on. Another question?
I have a question. My name is Lori. Hi, Dr. Luke from Las Vegas. Another very happy student, and I'm really glad that I am one of Dr. Luke's students and glad that I found him. I did some research in other schools, and I'm a happy one. The question being is, you say to write exactly what a patient says down to differentiate or to look into their delusions, but isn't it really what we want to kind of interpret from that, because they can't really tell us in words?
Well, they can tell us in words, indeed. They can tell us in words the delusion that they have, that's for sure. But what we can tell is what they actually do, how do they compensate. And when I said you really make sure to really write down almost literally what they said, it's because so many times I have seen that the patient really expresses him or herself in the words of the materia medica. So it becomes very important, and that we don't, You know, it's very easy for us to try to read something that is not there, or because we have a certain remedy in mind, and therefore we want to skew, you know, the information to the remedy that we have in mind. You know, when people say, I'm just trying to think about an example that I just recently had. When people say, for instance, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything unless I'm very sure that I can succeed in it. Then we cannot translate that in, like, delusion, cannot succeed in anything, because that's not what the patient says. The patient says, unless I'm sure that I cannot succeed, I won't do it. But if I can succeed, if I know that I can be succeeding, I'm going to do it. So that actually reflects not a delusion, does not succeed in anything. It actually reflects more the rubric, undertakes nothing unless he should not succeed. See, this is a different interpretation, and it's the correct one. And yet we must make very close attention to what this patient said. He didn't say, I'm not daring to do anything because I don't think I can do anything, I cannot succeed in anything. He just said, if I am not sure, I'm not going to do it. But if I'm sure, he will do it. It's a difference. So very carefully, we must try to see what the patient says in his compensations. And compensations, by the way, are, you know, I would say aphorism 153 maybe, but they might be far away from the core delusion because, you know, again, the patient, most of the time, does not know his core delusion, as you know. They are not aware of it. It is part of their secret story, I would say, that you, the homeopath, as a good detective, has to discover.
Right. Let's have one more question because we're getting running out of time here. So.
Yeah, by the way, I just want to share with everybody that the flu epidemic remedy of this year is Nux Vomica.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Nux Vomica is absolutely the genus epidemicus of this year. It really reflects very much Bryonia, the same cough, the same, again, dry cough, the same headaches, a very bursting headache. Also wants to be silent, wants to be alone, wants to be left alone, sensitive to noise, but also it goes together with some stomach pain, nausea, and at the same time, great fatigue and a low-grade fever. So I can tell you, don't think about arsenicum, don't think about bryonia, don't think about celcemium. Nux vomica is the genus epidemicus of this year, and you can either treat the patient as it comes up, or if you want to be preventive at work, which you could, just one teaspoon of Atari C once a month of Nux Vomica from now till March will be saving you.
Fantastic, Luke. Thank you for that information.
Actually, you are so correct that Nux Vomica is coming all the time because it is helping so much this year because all the flu, they are representing so much this. So I'm so happy that you are saying the same thing.
Great. Another confirmation. Fantastic. Let's have one more question.
I have a question. Dr. Luke.
Who is this?
This is Therese in Grizzly Flats, California.
Okay.
And my question is, would the loss of the death of a spouse merely be grief, or would that also trigger a feeling of being forsaken?
It's a very good question. I wish I had a half an hour now, but I'm going to answer it quickly. Certainly it can be doing both, obviously, right? So always ask the question, what did that do to you? And look carefully at what the patient did. I can certainly realize that. Imagine if you have been 50 years married. Maybe both people are already in a nursing home, or you are at home together. You're very much married in love for 50 years, and now one of the partners dies. You can imagine, you know, which is most of the time an autumn event, obviously, that it can give a sense of isolation, for sure, because, you know, that person means everything to you, and certainly it's a great grief because, you know, the love of their life has been lost, you know, the sunshine of their life, and I would think about autumn. But certainly it can do both, without any doubt. And obviously we might take both rubrics in account to find the remedy that is, if we think about an autumn, how would they react to this particular sense of isolation? They actually would withdraw. You know, don't forget that autumn is a very syphilitic remedy who will withdraw, will isolate herself from the world, and actually really do nothing anymore. I have seen those patients almost like, you know, a mummy. They don't react at all anymore unless you go and say to them, come, let's go and make a walk. Let's do something. Then they actually will come along. But otherwise, autumn patients, especially in that sense of isolation and grief, are the ones to be watched for, because they are the ones to commit suicide without telling anybody. So again, there's two. It's an excellent question. I wish I had like a half an hour to talk to you about it, but I love talking about those things.
Okay, so Luke, you know, I know we never have enough time with you because you have so much wonderful information to share, but I know who you are, and I know that you're going to call me up like next week and say you want to do another one of these calls, so I know it's not the last one. So anyway, I want to thank you personally again because these are such rich and such information valuable calls. I know that everyone who participates is really benefiting greatly. Let me unmute and let everyone say thank you to you directly.
Thank you, Dr. Luke.
From Kathleen in Boston.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Lou from Toronto, Canada.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from Colorado.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from Chicago.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from Spokane.
Thank you,
Dr. Luke from New York.
Okay,
thank you, Dr. Luke from Tucson, Arizona.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from Portland, Oregon.
Come back again.
Yes, okay,
Dr. Luke.
I'll be
Bye-bye.
Happy coming back. Bye, all my friends, and stay well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from Portland, Oregon.
Okay, Portland, wonderful city.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. from Toronto.
Okay, Toronto, Canada.
Hi, Dr. Luke. It's Cindy from Toronto.
Hi, Cindy. Hoe gaat het mevrouwtje?
Het gaat goed. Hartelijk bedankt voor alles vanavond.
Zeer graag gedaan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Luke, I really wanted to study with you to become your student. So I'd like to know your telephone number.
Okay, it's 505-982-9273. Or you can email me.
Yes, 505-982-9273.
Correct.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Luke.
Thanks, Dr. Luke.
Goodbye, all my friends, and just you always stay on the good path of homeopathy, and I really love homeopathy, and I love all the students in homeopathy. You're all worth it.
Yes.
Thank you for what you do in the world.
Thanks for teaching. Okay. Please teach us more.
Thanks again, Dr. Luke. You're the best.
Okay, thank you, my dear.
And thank you from Michigan.
Yes, Michigan. It's a cold there.
Ooh, yeah, well, it's not too bad.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from New York.
Thank you, Dr. Luke.
Okay, New York, the big apple.
Thanks.
Apple.
Thank you, Dr. Luke from Chicago.
Chicago, the windy city.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Dr. Luke, when are you going to do another one of these?
Well, anytime. Kim can ask me anytime. I love doing it for all of you. You know, I know it's kind of fun. I'm going to call it Evenings with Dr. Luke instead of Conversation with Morris.
Yeah. Cute.
Dr. Luke, I love your new book. It clears up so many misunderstandings.
But thank you very much. I really think, I really hope, I must say, that most people will adhere to it because, you know, I only have the patient's sake in my mind, and I can assure you when you follow those, you know, those guidelines, you really will have a lot more fun in your practice, and the patients will be very grateful. And that's of course, everything for us.
Yes, it's excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hello?
Hello.
Niet niks voor mekaar.
So. Dr. Luke, what will be the time to ring you?
What was it, what?
What time we should, I can ring
you?
Oh,
you can phone me any time as long as I'm here.
And the number is 505-982-9273.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Kim, could you give me a quick call, please? I don't know if Kim is still there. I just want to ask him something. Anyway, my friend, dear friends, good evening and goodbye, and I hope you'll meet each other again.
Yes,
okay,
so
take care.
Good
take
night,
good care. Okay, bye.
Bye.
This is the